Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, much of the extended lifespan humans are able to live today can be attributed to the control of pathogenic or dangerous microbes that make us sick. As a result, the promotion of health and attention to chronic disease is becoming a major focus in healthcare. However, we need to remember along the way, we're discovering a new appreciation of the health benefits provided by the much more abundant non-pathogenic microbes that evolved with us and are estimated to make up about 2% of our body weight. I'm co-host Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, authors David Montgomery and Ann Bickley are here on the program, or actually joining us by telephone from their home in Seattle. They're the authors of The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. Ann is a biologist who has interest in things like watershed restoration and environmental planning, as well as public health. And she's worked with a number of groups to improve environmental stewardship and urban viability, or livability projects. She is at this moment stuck in traffic, but we hope she will join us shortly on the program. But on the line from their home is David Montgomery. David is a MacArthur Fellow and a professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington. He is very much interested in landscape evolution and the effects of geological processes on ecological systems and human societies. He's actually written a couple of other books, one people in Alaska may have heard of, called King of Fish, The 1,000-Year Run of Salmon, which would be very attractive and interesting to people in Alaska. So hopefully some of you may be aware of that. Again, the name of this book is The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life. Dr. Montgomery, welcome to Line One.
Great, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. And Ann actually made it through traffic just a moment ago and walked in the door.
Anna, hello.
Hey, welcome. Nice to have you join us.
Yes, thank you very much.
I'll let you catch your breath, and while you're doing that, I'm going to tell everybody if they have questions or comments about the program today, here are three ways to get a hold of us. Our regular call-in number, 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. I'm going to ask us to start the program today by getting one or both of you to tell us a little bit about the general idea of this book. It's not the way I usually start, but it seemed like a good way to get into this one. So what's this book all about?
Well, you know, this book is the perspective from a geologist myself and a biologist, Anne, on the sort of amazing new emerging world of microbiome science in both plants and in people. And one of the reasons we're really excited about it is that it's really providing us with a whole different perspective on our relationship to nature, the way that nature really fundamentally works, and also a different perspective on the workings of our own bodies. And we came about putting this book together in kind of a roundabout path that we describe in the book, but is started with looking at the way that when Anne restored life to our yard and made a garden out of what had been essentially a pretty sterile urban lot, we recognized that microbial life, beneficial microbes, were the foundation for the ecosystem that was essentially built through her gardening efforts over the course of about a decade. And then through a health challenge that she faced, we started looking into the way that microbes interacted with the human body and our immune systems in particular. And when we started noticing parallels between those two systems, we really started going, whoa, wait, there's something really interesting and really cool going on here in terms of the way that nature works, the way our body works, that we were not really trained in the sciences that we practice, but that reshapes our view of things. And we got really intrigued, dove into it, and really realized that far more people need to know about the recent discoveries in these areas, and because it's changing, it's really a scientific revolution that's ongoing, and we don't get to live through too many of them.
We definitely want to hear about this scientific revolution, which I agree is extremely fascinating. And this is a medical program, but Ann, I want to start by helping listeners understand the kind of the process you all went through and a little bit more about microbes and soil and plant biology. Can you give us a couple of minute oversight on why and how microbes are beneficial and maybe, well, I should say, necessary for plant soil health.
Sure. Yeah, well, as it turns out, plants have just about everything they need sitting there in the soil in order to grow and thrive. And while that may not be obvious to someone who lives in a city and who is putting various things in the soil and thinking, oh, gee, if it weren't for me, these poor plants, they'd be in big trouble. But you go out to any kind of natural ecosystem, and nobody's farming or gardening out there, and yet we have thriving, vibrant communities of plants, you know, all across this globe. And as it turns out, all these various things in the soil, you know, macronutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus and down to micronutrients like manganese or cobalt or some of these sort of weird metals like zinc, in one way or another, the microbial world basically sort of assists plants in obtaining those things. And so a specific example would be mycorrhizal fungi. Will actually mine phosphorus out of rocks. Fungi have an ability to secrete acids at the tip of their sort of root-like structures that are called fungi. Those acids break down rocks, and the fungi suck up phosphorus, and there are these long, as I mentioned, long root-like structures, and they connect all the way to the root of the plant, not just to the outside surface of the root, but many of these fungi actually grow right inside and in between the cells that form the root of a plant. And so they are, you know, this fantastic nutrient acquisition and delivery service. And so in many ways, you know, that's just one example, but bacteria also participate in various ways of helping sort of break down rocks, and then the various things that the rocks are made of, these minerals, like say calcium or manganese or something, those then can be dissolved in water, and a plant can suck those up through their roots. Now, what's interesting, are these microbes doing this for free because they have goodwill toward plants? Well, no, not exactly. Plants, it turns out, with their, you know, monopoly on being able to turn sunlight into carbohydrates, they will strategically and specifically release these carbohydrates at their root surface. And this is what draws specific types of microbes to a root to do this, what we basically call, you know, sort of this underground economy. So there's this exchange of nutrients that microbes access in the soil. They get carbohydrates from the plant in exchange for those. So it turns out that these are sort of some of the basic mechanisms and processes that underpin the health of plants.
Right. So what I'm envisioning here is that you're out there helping this very distressed soil in your Seattle home site, and things are getting better, and everything's going, and then somebody stumbles on to this evolving science of the human microbiome that seems to be saying, you know, the same thing's happening in our intestines, in our lungs, and everywhere humans interact with your environment. Is that kind of the story?
Well, yeah, it is. You know, Dave and I had been reading up on all of this stuff in, you know, weird plant science journals, you know, the New Phytologist and, you know, Botany Today and things like that. And we were maybe about halfway through writing this book, and we had always intended to look into human health as part of the book. And then when I received a cancer diagnosis in 2011, that sort of further tweaked, in particular, you know, my interest in what is underpinning human health. Could there be some kind of a microbial basis for that as well? And I was, you know, doubly interested in that because my particular cancer is caused by a virus. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, you know, the warm and fuzzy and wonderful microbial world, it was sort of you know, I hold it at arm's length and just sort of consider the duality that, you know, we were facing, right? Like, on the one hand, the microbial world had been responsible for restoring the soil in our life and giving us this just incredible garden, and that transformed our lives. And then on the other hand, you know, not so nice things can come from the microbial world. So that's what sort of launched us into the human microbiome. And if we thought, you know, there was a lot of research to do in plant science on this, there is a lot on the human microbiome. You know, papers daily coming out, often, you know, some new shred of evidence or something that nobody had thought before, or it would tie together two other pieces of evidence. So that's sort of how we made the transition from plant science into human biology and human health.
You made the comment that microbes assist plants, if I can remember your words exactly. And in fact, that's exactly what we've known for a while, but we're really being reinvigorated how much non-pathogenic microbes in particular assist humans and human health. Is that kind of the bottom line and where the research seems to be taking us?
Yeah, it is. That seems to be the case. And, you know, and as we write in the book, we all have been walking around with these blinders on for quite a long time that has kept us focused on the harmful pathogenic microbes. And, you know, not surprisingly, infectious disease has not just tweaked, but, you know, it's upended the course of history, our own human history, any number of times. So we are quite interested, you know, in the bad actors here. And it's only been recently, since genomic sequencing has become less expensive, it's, you know, probably a mainstay in nearly every kind of cellular or molecular biology lab. And this was what I think really began to open the door for microbiome researchers, was looking at the incredible diversity on a genomic basis for the microbial world. And Dave, do you have anything to add to that?
Well, just the idea of even thinking about microbial life as being beneficial to higher organisms, to plants and animals, you know, to most of us was kind of a novel idea. I mean, we got sort of raised to, you know, to fight germs and to keep things clean, and because we viewed microbes through the lens of germ theory, that germs are pathogens and cause disease. So to me, this thinking about microbial life and on the positive part of their duality is a whole different way of actually looking at the world around me, the world around us, and it can help explain some of the connections that we see in the complexities in nature when we look into it that aren't immediately apparent otherwise. And part of that would be in looking at the soils, for example, of why would plants push out a quarter to a third of all the sugars that they make through photosynthesis into the soil. It seems incredibly stupid until you think that, oh, they're actually cultivating these partners that do things like generate plant growth-promoting hormones that they get in return. So I'm fascinated by this different lens and the different kind of explanations we can get for natural phenomena by looking at it in this relatively new way.
I kind of want to comment and make sure you guys have a chance to edit this, but Anne, you alluded to the fact that what really has allowed us to understand this in humans so much better was this molecular biology jump. Up until, I don't know, maybe it's 10 years ago, I don't know exactly, we assumed all the microbes around were things we could culture in a laboratory and grow, but it turns out that's just a very small percentage once we began to recognize that we could genetically sequence things that don't grow, and we found that there's far, far, far more of them. And so now we're finding things as strange as it appears that the placenta in a woman who's pregnant has bacteria in it, it now appears. There's been studies. So places that we thought were absolutely sterile are still now having microbes present, and we're going to talk about how they interact a little bit in a minute, but that's kind of what opened up the door, and I guess maybe to plant biology as well. I didn't think of it from that respect.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. You know, and lucky for us a long time ago that some of the major pathogens were culturable, because, you know, short of being able to do that, it'd be extremely difficult to, you know, develop vaccines or antibiotics or things like that. So the cultural ability of these various organisms has, you know, like as you said, yeah, it's true, up until recently hampered our ability to find out not only who they are, but almost more importantly, what it is they can do. And that's what some of the genomic sequencing is allowing scientists to understand is, oh, you mean this, you know, series of A's, T's, C's, and G's, you know, the specific sequence of base pairs in DNA, oh, you mean that codes for an enzyme that we humans can't make, but that enzyme turns out to be capable of, you know, either breaking down foods that we eat or making some kind of nutrient or vitamin in our bodies. I mean, that's sort of where a lot of this is going.
Let me just take a second to reestablish to listeners. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. My guests today are authors Dave Montgomery and Ann Bickley. We're discussing their book, The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. If you've got questions or comments, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. One thing we've known, I think at least people involved in science for a long time, that nature has a tendency to recapitulate itself. And what I was drawn to very quickly was your analogy of the root system of plants and the intestines of animals, particularly humans, because I've had a long interest in asthma, and I often explained how the lungs work very much like an upside-down tree, where the tree trunk is your trachea, where air enters the lungs. Those airways branch out like tree branches and end in alveoli, where exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide happen instead of in leaves like trees. And it helps people understand. It's not a perfect analogy. Can you bring us to a similar analogy to the intestines and this interaction between plants and microbes in the soil?
Yeah, that was something really kind of astonishing when we began to realize this. And one of our first clues about this parallel world is we, as I'd mentioned before, been doing a bunch of research on plant science, and exudates, root exudates, come up over and over again in the plant world. Then, you know, we turn our attention to human biology, and we're reading, like, you know, immunology and gastroenterology journals, and a couple of them were mentioning exudates. And we thought, exudates? What's going on here? And it turns out that human colon cells, so the cells that line our colon, are capable of producing a number of different molecules and compounds, and they call these exudates. And some of these exudates happen to provide nourishment for, it looks like, some of our gut microbiota. So this was interesting to us. A food source other than the diet of a person. That's quite interesting. The other, so that's the parallel, is it's this, the host, plant or person, providing nutrients in the form of exudates to these, you know, very specific types of microbial communities. The other thing that's quite interesting is that, just structurally, say, if you were to look at the small intestine, it's a lot like a root turned inside out. So what I mean by that is the lining of the small intestine has all these little tiny projections called villi. They're very, very much like root hairs. They hugely increase the surface area in the small intestine for the absorption of nutrients. This is exactly what a plant root is doing, you know, wandering around out there in the soil with all its root hairs. Is it's in contact with all of this stuff dissolved in water. These major and minor nutrients are in touch with bacteria and so on. So that's sort of a straight anatomical similarity. And more interestingly, when you get down to the colon, you no longer really have villi. You have these structures called colonic crypts. So whereas the villi stick up and project up, these colonic crypts are truly like these pouches that, that if you can picture this, that hang sort of downward to the outside of the colon wall. And in these crypts, it appears that there may be some of our microbiome living in these crypts. And what exactly it is they're doing there? Well, there's hypotheses that if you're some kind of a bacterium and you're trying to send messages, chemical messages and signaling to immune cells to instruct and guide them on who is friend and who is foe, living down in these crypts is a great place to do that because snugged right up against the outside of the colon wall is about 80% of our immune tissue, our immune system. So those are different types of immune cells and lymph glands and the lymph system. So the colon, the inside of the colon, is very much like this very active, biologically active, intense, super important zone on a root that's called the rhizosphere. So this is, up just, as close as you can get to a root without going inside of it is the rhizosphere. And in our colon lining, there's a very thick layer of mucus that we sort of liken to the rhizosphere mm-hmm. of a plant root. It's this zone where it's just incredibly dynamic and so much is happening in the communication and the signaling of our gut microbiota with our immune system. So that's sort of the parallel mm-hmm. worlds. And we've got, a number of pages on that in the book. We were so fascinated by it.
I particularly think it might be useful to help listeners understand that clearly these microbes in both plants and in humans are helping our metabolism, our energy, and so forth. But at least, and I have to apologize, I don't remember this necessarily from the plants, but in humans, we're now gaining an extremely important appreciation of the fact that these microbes actually train our immune system, as you hinted a minute ago. And in fact, without the microbes, we know experimental animals who are born in microbe-free environments, they really have struggle with somewhat like autoimmune diseases very quickly. So it raises the question that these microbes are important for normal health and are training our immune system, as you said, to recognize what's normal, what's normal and what's not, or what's healthy in the environment and what's not healthy in the environment.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Because if you think about it, what microbiome science is doing, and I think in some ways the plant scientists were a little ahead of those who study human biology on this front. Plant scientists have long known that plants are coated and live in this incredibly rich microbial environment. I mean, that's just the world of the soil, unless that is you're poisoning it and doing things like that. But it's otherwise, literally teeming with life. And so in human biology, if you consider that we also are living in a sea of microbes, we don't have our feet rooted in the soil or things like that, but we are also surrounded by microbes. And so that means that you start to look at the immune system in a really different way. And we've always known that the immune system, certainly one of its foremost purposes, is to recognize pathogens and try to rid them from our bodies. But what microbiome science is telling us is that there is a whole other aspect to our immune system that had not really been fully appreciated, and it's this. If we are, swimming through this microbial world from the day we come into it till the day we die, and actually on both ends of that, we need some way, some part of our body has got to be able to sort of serve as this master sort of surveillance system, if you will, telling the rest of our body, oh yeah, this one's okay. We've got one here. Not quite sure here. We're going to hold it in bay here, and you know, see what it does. Okay, you know, tons more microbes come through. Yeah, that one's good. So, the reason that our immune system sort of has to do that is because of the possibility of pathogens. But when you also consider that part of our evolution has been to recruit and retain these beneficial microbes because of the things that they are able to do in our bodies that we can't do for ourselves. Many of those things I just talked about, like in the gut with food digestion is one thing they help us with, and various metabolites and molecules they produce that we need. We certainly don't want our immune system attacking the microbes that are generating these, you know, basically medicinal compounds. Because if they start killing off our allies, then we're not going to be around. You know, we're not going to be around. So it's this, the immune system has, you know, a much bigger, broader job to do than I think anybody really appreciated. Until anyone appreciated. And then what the microbiome world is telling us is, oh, the immune system needs to look out not only for about the 1,400 known pathogens, but for the millions of either neutral or beneficial microbes that we don't even know all of the names of or where they exist. Oh, that begins to put a whole different spin on the nature of immunity and what our immune system does.
It's kind of a different paradigm, so to speak, a different way of looking at the immune system is what you're saying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Unfortunately for me, we're 30 minutes into this program, so I need to take a short break. If you guys will hang on, we're going to take a one-minute break. I want to remind listeners, this is Line 1, your health connection, our local number 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752, our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break and continue our discussion of the book, The Hidden Half of Nature, with authors Ann Bickley and David Montgomery. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, our discussion is on the book, The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health by authors Ann Bickley and David Montgomery, who are joining me by telephone from their home in Seattle. If you've got questions or comments, send them to us over the next 30 minutes at line1@alaskapublic.org. Locally, you can call us at 550-8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And always remember, if you're listening on Monday evenings between 8 and 9, that's a rebroadcast, and we won't be able to answer your questions. Anne, after listening to what you've brought us to a broader understanding and a different appreciation of our immune system, what I wrote down and what you guys do so well is you begin to ask the question, so what if you disturb this microbial-human interaction or maybe don't nurture it well? Maybe something not so good might happen. Is that where the book then turns?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's sort of the hypothesis, at least on the part of, you know, in the realm of human health and biology. You know, because if you were going to take a look, you know, over time at what people have primarily died from up until, you know, the advent of vaccines and antibiotics around post-World War II times, it was mostly infectious diseases. And we saw rapid drop-offs, at least in the developed world, around all those sort of traditional type infectious diseases. But we also saw around that time period steep increases in so-called chronic diseases and autoimmune diseases. So these are those, you know, that aren't thought to have an infectious agent. And what, you know, the working hypothesis is, and microbiome scientists are, you know, continuing to unravel this and see if facts are hitting or are fitting the hypothesis or not, is that, you know, is part of this problem that maybe we're missing some of our microbes, some of these microbial communities that we co-evolved with. And it's a logical thing to think if you think about the amount of antibiotics that all of us probably have taken it maybe at some point in our lifetime, that we know our great-great-grandparents, you know, were not taking. And then the other thing that's a part of this hypothesis is how our diet has changed, you know, in the last 50, 60, 70 years. And what is that doing to our microbial communities that, you know, they can only eat, you know, so much, and we don't want them eating too much of the mucus and other exudates that we produce in our colon, because those serve purposes in our own body. But what if we are not feeding them the types of things that they're able to derive nourishment from? So that's a little bit of the story here. And Dave, do you want to say something about the plant world here on this?
Well, there's parallels in terms of the plant world. If you think about the kind of metabolites that the beneficial microbial communities, whether in your colon or in the inner soil of your colon or the outer soil that we think of as the soil out in the world and on farm fields, it's what those microbes have to eat, in effect, what they can metabolize that will greatly structure the kind of metabolites that they then produce. And those are the things that can either be very beneficial for us if they're eating the right things and producing the right metabolites, or that can be fairly detrimental. And that's where the makeup of the community of microbes, whether in the soil or in your body, can really matter to what happens to either things we put in the soil or filtered through what we actually eat. There's sort of direct connections between the diet, if you will, of a plant or the diet of a person and what their respective microbiomes are going to be able to make out of that diet. And there's pretty strong evidence that there can be fairly rapid responses in the microbial communities in either environment to changes in the supply of food for them. And there's a lot of work that's been going into trying to figure out, well, what are the different metabolites that are being made and how do those affect and interface with the health of the host organism that those microbial communities are living on, around, and within. So there's some pretty direct connections there between diet in a broad sense and the role that the microbes can play, beneficial or not, in both plant and human bodies.
We have an email from someone who gets this, which is always nice to see. The writer says, "Fascinating. I cannot get my microbes to get my compost to compost, but of more concern to me is the composting that goes on in my intestines. I have type 2 diabetes and wonder if the flora fauna in my gut might be adjusted to better enable or disable my body's carbohydrate processing." And then they say, "Is that something on point for today's discussion? And I'm going to say, "Absolutely." And then he says, "Do your guests have any thoughts? Do you want to expand this diet, nutrition, obesity, diabetes connection?" Because he's right on.
Yeah. That's a very astute listener you've got there. I was just sort of earlier today, kind of preparing for our interview by reading some of the, you know, some more recent papers that have come out on this, and one little factoid that kind of stuck in my head is they've looked at the makeup of the gut microbiota of so-called normal or healthy people compared to those with type 2 diabetes, and it seems that one thing is that those with type 2 diabetes have a less diverse microbiota in their gut. And I think they're sort of, again, is it chicken and egg? Was it right. like that right. before the type 2 diabetes hit, or is that a consequence of the type 2 diabetes? And so that's what I can say about that. I do know that there have also been some recent studies. There's a drug called metformin, one of the most inexpensive and, I think, quite effective drugs for treating type 2 diabetes. And there's been a fair amount of work done on the relationship or linkages between that drug and the composition of a person's gut microbiome. And it appears that that drug is most effective when, and I can't recall details on this, but that drug is most effective in the presence of a certain composition of a gut microbiota.
Mm-hmm.
And so what this is telling, you know, a lot of clinicians and researchers is it's not just metformin. There are a number of other drugs, from those used in chemotherapy to all kinds of things that, well, guess what? You know, that to our microbiome, that's another kind of thing that we are putting into our bodies. And microbes are, if nothing else, very capable of breaking down many, many different kinds of compounds. And so I think depending on who's living in you, either these drugs are going to be, you know, they'll be working as expected, they might not be working as well, or they might be overworking. And so this is then where, you know, dosages need to be adjusted and so on and so forth. But I would hazard a guess that most doctors have not thought about the composition of a gut microbiome as the reason behind a drug working or not working. So that's if your listener, I'm sure if they get onto the internet, now they need to do is put metformin and microbiome into the search engine, and they'll learn a lot more about that.
When you think back and realize that there's really been a natural experiment that's been going on for a number of years in animal husbandry, and that's for some reason it was discovered that given antibiotics to chickens and pork and various and sundry animals that we would like abundant, we make them bigger and provide more of the meat perhaps that we're after. And I'm not sure I've ever seen a good explanation of that. And it really is somewhat counterintuitive, but it begins to raise the question as to whether or not the antibiotics are working by changing the microbiome. And then you combine that with studies somewhat more recently where you look at laboratory animals, usually these are mice or rats, where you have an obese rat and a non-obese rat, and they're grown in different cages where you can control everything about their environment. And these animals have a very strange predilection to eating each other's poop. But then you put the poop from the fat mouse in the skinny mouse's cage, and that's all he's eating. And then he's eating the same diet he's always eating. He gets fat. It makes you start realizing that the microbiome's got, you know, we got to start paying attention to this thing. These are simple but repeatable studies that really has driven also along with this ability to the molecular biology to really begin to understand. But these kinds of things are what's driving us to try to figure out what's going on better.
Yeah, and some of these things are things that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you would have been called kind of crazy if you'd proposed it to NIH as a real experiment.
Right, right.
And that's really a sign of a sea change in the way that we're looking at things. And I think that's where there's some of the great both of promise and frustration potential in this whole sort of new view of microbiome science, where you know, thinking about your microbial community in your gut as another independent dimension of what may be influencing your health, the way you metabolize things, and the way drugs may work in your body, it adds a lot of complexity to trying to ferret out, you know, causality from correlation and trying to figure out what's really driving some of the larger scale patterns that we see. But that opens the promise to, if we can figure some of those things out and get the connections, it may open the door to, you know, new and what could be seen as fairly novel treatments for things that are hard to treat today. But again, it could be frustrating in terms of having to try and go through all the steps to try and figure out, well, what's really driving things, and which is the chicken, which is the egg. And those same kind of questions come up in agricultural science in terms of what we should feed our plants and how we can deal with fertilizers and pesticides and organic matter and all the complexity and in the plant world. But so there's this, again, this duality of promise, that this new perspective is going to open doors, and try and explain things like that problem of feeding antibiotics to livestock and having them you know, fatten up much faster, which then has produced this, you know, has greatly accelerated the rise of antibiotic resistant microbes.
Right. Yeah, and it gives me the opportunity, and I don't want to, I'm not at all intended to throw water on any of this. I think it's extremely interesting and it's going to be very important. But the history of science and medicine and civilization is we sometimes get ahead of the science, and we want to be really careful about the risk-benefit ratio of what we're reading and what we're doing. And it sounds to me like you guys, you would agree with this, and we're beginning to understand it, and a lot of people want to already start doing something, but we need to be a little careful about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, because in many cases we still just see correlation between things, and we don't understand causal mechanisms. I would have to say, you know, one place that it has really gotten ahead of the science is in the area of probiotics. And you know, so probiotic is simply an organism that a microbe, usually bacteria, that is introduced into, you know, in pill form. Some people, maybe some of your listeners, have taken probiotics. That's ahead of the science, and we don't know in all cases what probiotics are effective at treating what conditions, at what dosage, at what frequency. And so I think there's a lot of promise in probiotics, in particular because this could be a way that would allow us to more effectively use antibiotics. And so, which we need, you know, people get infections all the time, and they truly are a miracle drug. But the way that we're using them and the effects that it has on our microbiome are not good for us. So if we could figure out, you know, at the tail end of a course of antibiotics, okay, we know that, let's say, vancomycin, that's really hard on our, you know, I'm making this name up, you know, it's really hard on our Bacteroides, and so we're going to develop the probiotic that's going to replace what the antibiotic that took out, not the pathogen, of course, but I mean, we're going to replace the beneficial bacteria that antibiotic took out, and then we're you know, truly using what we know about our microbiome and its potential to keep us healthy. It's sort of this marriage of the best of modern medicine with you know, some traditional practices.
What we've also, I think, the flip side of that is that we've gotten some insights just from this new perspective that allow us to start thinking about steps that we could take that would be fairly low risk in terms of thinking about different ways of preventing conditions that we don't like, as opposed to treating them, where I think a lot of the risks that Anne's talking about lie. And that goes into the idea of, we understand enough now about some of the mechanisms that support the beneficial microbes in the colon or in the soil, and what they need as a diet to produce the compounds that have already been shown to be very beneficial to the host organism, that the idea of simple practices or changes in practices, changes in our diet or changes in what we put into the soil, can actually help cultivate those beneficial communities. And may not be enough to actually cure conditions that have already been established from changes in a microbiome, but may be essential as a way of thinking about how to promote the continued health and cultivating the beneficial ones. And that boils down to some fairly simple things. In the soil, it's organic matter, the kind of stuff that Anne was putting on our yard that actually supported the microbes that break that material down and recycle it into the things plants can take up and support new life. And in our colon, it's essentially the fiber fermenters. I mean, there's nutritionists seem to have... there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of controversy over the idea that more fiber in the American diet and defeating those fiber-fermenting microbes in our colon that produce the beneficial metabolites, things like butyrate that nourishes your colon lining, for example, those are kind of steps that could be argued that we know enough already to essentially promote as low-risk things that could help and benefit people's health, but we don't know enough to sort of say, yes, it will, it will treat this or that condition. Those kind of things, I think, are still, with some exceptions, in progress.
All right. I have a caller. I want to take his call. Vic, you're on line one.
Yes. I know your focus is on humans, but I was just wondering if you've looked into some of the animal literature, particularly ruminants. Moose are ruminants, and they've got this great big rumen full of a mixture of vegetation and microorganisms that act to break down that vegetation. And one of the interesting things with that is the seasonal changes that occur from summer to winter diets. In the summertime, they're mostly eating leaves, which are very high in protein and very digestible. In the wintertime, twigs, which are just the opposite. And they require entirely different suites of microorganisms to break them down. And so the question is, how does that process work in determining that changeover?
Yeah,
no, looking into some of the other animals, animal life was a fascinating part of doing some of the background research for the book. And the ones we looked at in particular were cows and termites. And to me, at least, I was really somewhat surprised that the degree to which I always thought, cows eat grass, right? Well, cows eat grass, but they're eating the grass and chewing it up really finely because it's the microbes in the rumen that it's actually breaking that cellulose down into compounds that the cow then absorbs. So the cow is eating grass to feed the microbes that in turn feed the cow. And, we're not that familiar with moose down here, but that sounds fascinating, and it sounds like they would have a very dynamic seasonal microbiome, the way you're describing.
Yeah, I think I'm speculating here a little bit, but what I would guess is that moose or any other wild, animal with a rumen is the diet one season is really feeding and therefore boosting up the numbers of certain species of bacteria, and then as that diet begins to change seasonally to another thing, it's not that the other ones, say the twig eaters, are completely gone. It's just that their numbers have been just knocked way back because the moose isn't eating, as many twigs. And then when the twig supply goes up, the twig eaters in the rumen go, great, what we've been waiting here, for 4 months for all the twigs to come back in. So their numbers, skyrocket, and the leaf eaters, in the room and are, oh boy, looks like, you know, this, the supply is dwindling. Okay, everybody, you know, let's head into hibernation here. So I would guess that the communities in the rumen are, you know, as adapted as the moose is itself to these sort of waxes and wanes, if you will, of different foods. It's fascinating, though.
Oh, I think that's right. And another question is, you know, a newborn moose does not have any of those rumen microorganisms. And so how does a moose calf acquire them? And the moose biologists seem to think that it's through licking by the mother. But that must be a somewhat complex process, too, in order for a calf to build up what it needs in the way of microorganisms fairly quickly, because young calves start feeding on leaves and twigs as early as a week old.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
I would hazard a guess here too. These young calves are also nursing on, you know, moose mom, and you know, moose. We're mammals. Moose are mammals, and at least when it comes with people, there are complex sugars in milk, and it's the same but different sugars in moose, and so the sugars get into a calf, and the calf has some kind of microbial communities that are just beginning to grow, and it's these complex sugars in milk that can supercharge the growth of some of these microbial communities, and that may be what's occurring in these first days of life, such that, you know, by the time, you know, the seventh, eighth, ninth day or so, and so on come around, there's enough of a beginning microbial community that is then set up to be able to start breaking down the organic matter, leaf, twig, or whatever a calf might be taking in.
And I believe there's a different way that zebras in Africa actually do this, where zebra calves will actually eat the feces of their parents to try it. And basically there's a thought that that is to essentially, that's how they get their microbiome seeded.
Vic, okay, thank you.
Yeah, Vic, I need to move on. Thanks very much. Very interesting phone call. Very interesting conversation. Thank you very much. Quickly, I have an email, and I'm going to try to address this, but I want, because I want it to be answered, but because I'm the physician here. But if you guys have something you want to add that I'm not aware of, let me know. The writer says, how does having a Roux en Y, which is a type of gastric bypass, affect the gut microbiome? Is this the reason why people who have had this procedure have problems with absorption of certain nutrients? And I would answer that is, once you do this bypass, you are bypassing the normal digestive system, and that clearly can have an effect on digestion. However, I don't know that this is true, but it's very likely that the gastrointestinal biome has been changed by simple surgeries of the intestinal tract as well. I don't know that we really have that information. Either one of you all want to comment on that?
Yeah, the only thing I know about bariatric surgery and the microbiome is that for whatever reason, some of the continued ability to keep weight off has to do with a more diverse microbiome. And so they've looked at microbiomes before and after that surgery, and post-surgery, the microbiome is more diverse. And it's been, a more diverse microbiome has been linked to, you know, healthier responses to intakes of fats and sugars and so on.
I want to take just a second, and I hope kind of make this a comic interlude, and I get back to another question we've got. I've written down that I guess I can't be the only reader of The Hidden Half of Nature who's had on their mind, boy, I would like to see these people's yard and garden if you read the first half. And so my next, what I wrote down is, there must be, you guys must have gawkers or have had to open up garden tours. Are you getting a lot of people that show up in your front yard, you don't know who they are?
Oh, boy. I expect as the weather gets better and more people are out and about and figure out where the house is, that might start occurring. Yeah, so the gardeners, so we'll be a little bit panicked come springtime here with, you know, making sure things are looking tip-top.
Yeah, but Anne gets questions from people walking by the house all the time of sort of, what are you doing here? How do you do this?
All right, here's a last question. We only got about 3 minutes left or so. This gets very serious, but again, somebody's paying attention to what's going on here. Could you ask the guest to discuss possible links between microbial metabolites in your gut and how you think? Do microbes control some of our feelings towards what we want to eat? Effects on mental illness. So another and very intuitive question. How would you answer that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's been one of the really difficult things for us in finishing this book was that as we were trying to wrap it up, every week there'd be sort of new papers in Science and Nature and some of the journals we were looking at that would be making new connections. Some of those were about the gut-brain axis, the idea that your gut microbia are influencing the way we think, our moods. There's some pretty solid relations to the production of serotonin in your gut. That's one of those neurotransmitters that makes you happy.
Yep.
And there's links that have been posited to depression. That's one of these areas where I think there's going to be a lot more discoveries in terms of what those connections are in ways that 20, 30 years ago would have been thought to be crazy.
And there's absolutely something there. I mean, we know that the gut is sort of, you know, headquarters central for our body. You know, about 80% of our immune system is associated with our gut. And it turns out an awful lot of our nervous system is also associated with our gut. And it looks like, you know, these nerve cells that are, you know, just snugged right up there against, you know, our intestinal wall, just like the immune cells, have receptors. And these receptors are for some of these microbial metabolites and molecules. And so here you've got sort of a straight line, if you will, from gut to brain. So we've got microbiota, you know, munching away on what we send down the hatch. They produce these byproducts. Some of those latch on to nerve cell receptors in the gut, and signals are headed up to the brain. So that is yet to be unraveled. I would say that's probably one of the latest and most exciting areas of microbiome research right now.
Well, I have to say goodbye. It's been a wonderful hour, and I want to do this by saying if you think this is complex, wait till you start thinking about the other evolving science of epigenetics, where we're realizing the environment also affects our genomes and the genomes of our microbiome, and things are going to get very complicated, but very interesting. Thanks very much for taking the time to be with us today.
Yeah, we had a blast. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks much. It was a pleasure talking to you.
My thanks to our guests, Ann Bickley and David Montgomery. If you want to know more about this evolving science of hidden of the microbes in our health, get their book, The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. There's a link on the Line One website and also a link to several good websites about the human microbiome. Remember also that you can continue the conversation on Facebook. You can find that link at alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to be talking about decisions in medicine in particular. And when you think about it, a lot of medical decisions have to deal with uncertainty. Sometimes the tests are not very perfect. Patients may not completely explain their symptoms, so we misunderstand. Sometimes the decision requires information that physicians really don't have at the time they need to make the decision. But when you think about it, uncertainty is present in almost all of the decisions we make daily. Next week, Dr. John Brush will discuss a book that he's recently written called The Art and Science of Medicine, which is designed to help physicians make better decisions, but I think we can all benefit in making better decisions from understanding this. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron is our audio engineer. Our next program, I didn't say, is January 4th. We'll be off next week. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.